Welcome to the Talking Poem Podcast. I'm your host, Charlie Green. On this episode, I have as my guest poet Nicholas Mulbert. He is the author of the brand new collection, Altars of Spine and Fraction, which is out from Northwestern University Press just this month. It's really fantastic. You can find his work in Cincinnati Review, the Greensboro Review, Mississippi Review, Missouri Review, and others. He holds a PhD from the University of Cincinnati and an MFA from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today we talk about Tommy Blunt's poem, Icarus Does the Dishes, and then a poem of Nick's as well. Thanks for listening, and we'll join the conversation in progress. I have to ask, because you are the first, you're a personal trainer, right?
Yeah, somewhat. Yeah. Okay. I coach group classes, but also do some personal training. Yeah. That's one of my few gigs.
Well, you're the first personal trainer slash poet that I've had on.
Okay. Nice.
Unless Kim Adnizio has a secret career.
Oh, maybe.
I don't think she does. But the answer to this has to be no. But is there any relationship at all between the personal training and the poetry? Like there's a middle ground, which is that you write about the body a lot.
It's just always something that I've done. No, you know, a bunch of my friends. So the only other poet that I knew that did that was actually in my MFA. Which is weird. I'm sure there are others, you know, but his book won the Miller Williams Prize years ago. And he has these poems about weightlifting. And everybody always asks me, you know, like, do I write poems about? I was like, no, they're all terrible. All the ones that I've tried to write are absolutely horrendous. But Jess Williard, like, he has really good poems about weightlifting. But no, I haven't. I don't teach writing anymore, which I did for years. So this is kind of the way for me to keep teaching in a way. You know, I moved to Los Angeles recently, so I've had to piece together odd jobs. I couldn't land a teaching job, so it's, you know, you're trying to do two or three different things at once.
Soon you will be poet personal trainer to the stars.
That's right.
Just gotta break into the level, not too famous.
Yeah.
Well, today you brought in Tommy Blunt's poem Icarus Does the Dishes. It's from his 2020 collection Fantasia for The Man in Blue, which for listeners was a National Book Award finalist. And I'll ask you, Nick, to go ahead and read the poem and then we'll talk about it.
Icarus Does the Dishes by Tommy Blount. It leaves a mark when I fall in my father's kitchen. Only a few days it's been of lifting him up from one place, then putting him down somewhere else, then driving to work for the late shift while a nurse looks after him for 5 hours, three times a week. All we can afford. There is no choice. Sometimes I have to leave him alone. I ignore the soreness of the bruise taking shape on my ass because these dishes won't clean themselves and father hasn't had his bath. It embarrasses us, especially the rolling back of his foreskin, the veins, tiny stitches on the inside of a minotaur's mask. So I let him wash that part while I look away. He does not see me this way, on the floor. I'm 25 and agile. It is no accident, but a tantrum. I throw the dishes, all around me, shards, a constellation, stars for which I have no names. We are lost. What have I done, I'm thinking now, in telling the hospital I can do this, I can manage just fine. In the next room, through the wall, he asks me if I'm okay, if I need him to do anything. Please die, I whisper, then sweep the stars, turn back toward the sun, soaking in the gray water.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm really glad you chose this poem. Why did you choose this poem? Sort of main reason.
Yeah, I remember before Fantasia for the Man in Blue, I read this poem in the Kenyon Review. Had to be years and years ago. And I'd never heard of Tommy Blount before. And I just read the poem. And at the time, I was writing poems that eventually would make it into Altars of Spine and Fraction that were about kind of the elegies for my grandfather. And I just remember thinking, this is probably one of the most moving poems I've ever read about caretaking. Just the honesty, that turn in, you know, the last three lines. There's also tenderness, which I strive for in my poems as well, and a kind of honesty that I really admire.
Yeah, I think I agree with all that. And I love that he does it through making Icarus the main character. I always love when contemporary poems sort of pull on ancient mythology, which always feels very distant to me. It always is, it feels like lore. And then there's something kind of beautifully defamiliarizing about making that character in the present. And I'm curious why you feel like he chooses Icarus, or like what are the things you see here in terms of why Icarus?
Even for somebody who isn't super interested in myth like me, the fall of Icarus, I think, is a large enough or well-known enough myth to be accessible. But also, we have the complication of pride or hubris is the fall of Icarus in the myth. And it's the same, I think, here, but kind of turned on its head, where we have the pride or the hubris of a son thinking that he can take care of the father despite financial means, which the first part of the poem, sometimes he has to leave him alone because he can't afford this nurse. The fact of hubris being turned into love or kind of necessity, I guess, instead of how it is in the myth of just kind of like, oh, the ecstasy of flight. Icarus just couldn't contain himself. He just flew too close to the sun, kind of thing. How Blount kind of turns pride and hubris into necessity of caretaking, I thought was kind of astounding.
Yeah, I love that. I love that because it's just sort of flipping it. We tend to think of it as Daedalus, the father, warning Icarus, don't do this. And there are all these different echoes that I like. It is as if they are trapped in a maze. It's not exactly a maze, but like you mentioned, which I think is central to the poem, the sense that they can't afford anything beyond what they can do with insurance, and that is a kind of trap. That there's also humor in it. Just the opening line, it leaves a mark when I fall, which is just kind of, fun, sounds funnily understated thinking about it, but then it gets very quickly into the different material. So we get this sort of nice light way in, but there are other echoes as well that I think are really good. And I have to say this because I was, you mentioned the story of Icarus is so, is well known enough, and I hadn't thought about this at all until you mentioned that there is a very famous poem, the Ode in Musée des Beaux-Arts, about the painting, of Bruegel's painting of the fall of Icarus. I did not think of it once when I was reading and rereading this poem. And I feel like that speaks to what the poem is, the originality of the poem. That's something I find really appealing here, that it's taking the myth, and we don't necessarily have to see it as like a response where it isn't in the tradition of Ode in that way.
There's something really compelling to me about the marriage of the mythical and the mundane. And there's a really helpful and illuminating article on the Kenyon Reviews website, I think by Marjorie Little. They must have been running a series for Kenyon Review on why the editors chose certain poems for the magazine. And they probably spotlight one or two from each issue. But Marjorie Little, in this kind of review, mini review of the poem, talks about the juggling act of marrying the mythical to the mundane. And I think because it is so much about the mundane, washing dishes, caretaking for an ailing father, we don't get to Auden for some reason.
Which is funny because the Auden poem is very much about the same thing, all these mundane things happening, and Icarus is on the side, but here it's Icarus is doing the mundane things. I also just really like that the mythical figure being brought down to life size. That's always, whether it's Yeats's lead in The Swan, he's not life size because he's still a swan, but it's the scene is so intimately rendered that he's down to human scale in a way. So what are the, I'm curious, like favorite things you have in the poem, just little things, or I mean, I guess maybe we should just focus on the end, the turn, please die, I whisper, then sweep the stars, turn back toward the sun, soaking in the gray water. And you said that turn really hit you when you first read this poem.
You mentioned the kind of maze. They're trapped. The speaker and the father are trapped, and they're not only trapped, they're trapped separately in the same house, right? One is in the kitchen, one is in another room on the other side of a wall. And I guess I was just struck by that fact, the separation of the father and the son gets amplified with that phrase, please die. I would imagine maybe the speaker surprises himself by saying that, but it's not said to the father. It's kind of said in confidence, so that those dynamics are, it's complicated. And then, you know, the son, the S-U-N, the last image we have, I think at once we think of the son, the father can somewhat feel like the son, the S-U-N, right? The patriarch of a family, maybe the person that family revolves around, until we get this kind of role reversal where the son is caretaking. But we also, it's the son is also falling. The thing that in the myth causes Icarus to fall, in this poem, falls itself into the gray water of where the dishes are soaking. So it's no, in level, and the sun is no different than the dish that's being washed in a way by the end of the poem. There's just a lot in those last three lines, I think. Talking now to you, it's kind of unraveling even more. So
I love it, because I love it any time a poem has this kind of, these two things that are so different in scale, that is, you know, sweep the stars toward the sun, and the last line is just soaking in the gray water, that we have something so small and intimate as that. And that's something that I think part of what gives the poem some of its emotional power, as you mentioned, you know, he's just saying, please die, to himself. And so we are suddenly the confidant in a way. The poem is so good at the intimate kind of details. And I don't mean intimate sexual, but I mean like kind of zoomed in, the describing the rolling back of his foreskin, the veins, tiny stitches on the inside of a minotaur's mask. And so we stay with that image. And it's just, it's really powerful because it creates this sense of vulnerability. It's also, it's referring back to the myth, but giving it a different kind of tone. It's a powerful poem. And I keep admiring more and more the ways that it kind of refers to the myth and deepens it. It feels essential to the poem. It doesn't feel like an arbitrary choice.
Something that I really admire about the poem as well is, and you touched on this a little bit, is how the confidant of certain information, or who gets access to what information throughout the poem, changes, and the scope changes, right? We get the fall in the kitchen, and then we get kind of zoomed out context for the actual caretaking situation, right? Only a few days it's been of lifting him up from one place. And then you get 5 hours, three times a week. And then we get the foreskin lines where it's like very zoomed in, and even more zoomed in because he is actually looking away while the father is taking care of himself, kind of thing. Just that manipulation of scale and the kind of camera work is astonishing to me in such a short poem. I mean, this is a relatively short poem, I think.
And, you know, it's funny. I like that you use the word camera work, because it's not just that we're intimate in all these different ways. It's the, you know, we hear the whisper, and I hadn't really put this in that category, but we see all this happening to Icarus, and then we also learn he does not see me this way on the floor. Right. And so there's, again, this kind of reminding us that we are in this story in a different kind of way, which a poem already does that. Or, you know, usually it's as if we are the confidant, which gives a lot of lyric poetry its power. But here it's emphasized so much that when he says, please die, it could feel, in certain kinds of circumstances, obviously really harsh and cruel. But here it's just, there's such a different kind. There's so many emotional valences in there. You know, there's
it's everything at once.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exhaustion, wanting his father to be relieved of pain. You know, the selfishness is not quite the right word, but the desire to be free of that pain himself.
And I'm thinking also of the kind of the middle bottom of the poem where it says, I'm 25 and agile. It is no accident, but a tantrum. I throw the dishes, where the father doesn't, you know, the father asking if he needs him to do anything, you know, the father thinks it's an accident, where, you know, there's such frustration by the speaker that even if he fell by accident, it's not an accident that he throws the dishes. Which, speaking of who gets access to what detail, you know, the father, the son, and the readers, it's a great couple of lines as well. And like super simple on the language level, you know, there's not a ton of gymnastics done in this poem, which is my favorite kind of poem, just honesty and kind of emotional complexity at its finest.
Yeah, the language is all very, I know people get mad about using the word accessible with poetry, but it's very straightforward. It's mostly sort of narrative step by step, and it's all language that any reader is going to know, and yet has, because of that, generates a lot of the emotional energy that it does. I was going somewhere with this and I've kind of lost it.
Yeah. And there's, I think the other kind of brilliance, it might not be, you know, it doesn't necessarily hit us over the head with rhyme or anything like that, but line breaks. You mentioned the first line, "It leaves a mark when I fall." But also when we're talking about that kind of intimate part in the middle, "Tiny stitches on the inside of a minotaur's mask, so I let him wash that part while I look away. He does not see me, line break, this way." Whereas if the speaker letting the sun do, like, wash himself while the speaker's there, it's as if he's by himself again and able to kind of take care of himself without the sun's help. Just a simple line break like that is great.
They're nice line breaks here. Even though I have to leave him alone, I ignore the soreness and a break there. And for a moment, it's his being alone is the soreness, and I think that this is probably true of people having to do this kind of caretaking, that in order to do it, you have to, as much as possible, try to suppress emotion because it's such a dire kind of situation. Mm-hmm. I say that not having been in the situation myself, but it feels like that's part of the dynamic there. You mentioned there's not a ton of play with sound. There's enough. There's a lot of internal rhyme and echo, like "around me shards, a constellation, stars." There are moments like that throughout the poem, but it's subtle. It's not drawing a lot of attention to itself, which I think helps the feeling of it being a sort of naturally spoken kind of lyric. Any other things you want to draw our attention to or mention? I have a question I want to ask in a minute, but I want to leave it for the end.
Looking back over it, not especially. I came back to this poem whenever I knew I was going to be on this show and had to talk about a poem. I was just kind of racking my brain of all the poems that I could talk about. And there's obviously tons of them. But I hadn't read this poem for years. And I remember I read it and posted it on my Instagram and then not forgot about it, because I read Tommy's book after this. And, you know, I kind of followed him because of this poem. But it was nice to kind of have that break and then to, like, return back to it and dive into it.
I find that what often happens with the show, because most of the time people are sending me poems that I'm not as familiar with. I haven't spent a lot of time with. And this poem in particular had, you know, that sort of immediate emotional power. And as I reread the first few times, I feel like, well, all I want to do is just kind of point and say, this is a great poem, which doesn't make for much of a show, by the way. I don't think, but the more time that I've spent with it, and I know I'm going to spend more time with it, I'm actually going to send it to a student of mine who's really interested in mythology and bringing that in. I'm going to send it to her in part. She's really, really fantastic young writer. She sometimes tries to keep an elevated language when she's writing about mythology. And I think she'll appreciate this as being down to earth language. Having that mythology, but I feel like I'm going to keep spending more time, and it's just going to keep doing things. In part, the shards, there's reference in it, like, for example, in the mythology, to there being kind of like shards of broken things inside the maze. There's just all this makes me want to go back to the, you know, sources and play more with the poem and that. So
the Minotaur's mask, you know, is another thing that is kind of dropped in there, and then but it also, like you said, connects to the myth and the maze, and kind of the way that the figure in the myth is meant to wander the maze tirelessly, you know, in the way that caretaking day after day can also feel inescapable in a way. So it's interesting to think of the poem as a maze, where even the sun, the S-U-N, is, like, in the end, is trapped in the water.
It's fun in a way, if you sort of take it outside the context of the poem. It's fun. He's overturning and creating this ironies with the mythology, but it doesn't feel like play. It doesn't, for me, undermine the intensity of the poem, but deepens it, which I think is really impressive. I'm going to tell you what my question was, and I've realized in talking that I think I no longer agree with the premise of the question. A couple times that I was rereading the poem, I found myself wanting it to keep going after the end. And I think part of it is a narrative interest, but also I think I was curious to see the poem go beyond the please die. But I realized, one, in our conversation, just there's so much depth in the poem that it doesn't need more. The other thing I've been realizing, so I've been, before the semester starts, this will come out in September, but recording it in August, I've been binge watching Lost, which I never watched before, which is, it's entertaining in a lot of ways and it's very watchable, but they're always interested in the surprise of plot much more than the surprise of character. And I think I'm just so in the mode of thinking, well, what if you did this earlier in the episode? And then we saw the ramifications in a different way. So I think my mind is just locked in.
Very stupid.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting. The last image is a pretty quiet image. On the surface, quiet. I mean, there's all these valences like we talked about. But it's a different poem than if it ends on the words, please die, right? So it's interesting to think about, you know, what if we didn't have the last two lines and we just had the please die answer?
Yeah, I'm glad it doesn't end on please die. I think it's very much it would have a shock value to it, but
yeah,
the way it's embedded at the start of that sentence, I think helps those last images do more complex compounding work.
Right.
Let's move to a poem of yours. So for listeners, I've mentioned this in the intro, but I'll mention it again. Nick, your book, this is your first collection of poems, is coming out in September. Do you have a specific date?
The 15th.
September 15th. I had that in my head and I couldn't find it. And I was worried that it was not. But September 15th, it's coming out from Curbstone Books, which is an imprint of Northwestern University Press. The title is Alders of Spine and Fraction. I'm very happy to say that Nick was kind enough to share advanced reader's copy with me. And I think it's a fantastic collection. It's very sound rich, which that's the easiest draw for me on the level of the poem. But there's also so much going on with humor and with, you know, the body, but also the soul, because there's lots of writing about and playing around with a religion, as the title suggests. Yeah. And so you're going to read your poem Cup Licking, which actually puts this kind of square in terms of all the things I've just mentioned. So go ahead and read it and then I'll talk a little bit about it. I won't make this too painful for you, I hope.
Yeah, I'd love to. Cup Licking. Only after leaning over the couch's chasm between my beloved and me to lick the coffee hugging the side of her favorite mug, Dr. S is at your cervix, did I remember this licking is not acceptable, not delightful everywhere. For example, in mass, after you sip the blood from the chalice, and you might, like me, not always be the best sipper with an audience of humans, yes, but also the Lord's legions of angels, archangels, patron saints, punching hours, manning helplines, the saints I bothered with tasks of retracing my steps toward my umpteenth lost house key. Sorry also to you, human whose name I do not know, whose eyes I stare into as I say amen and bow my head Sunday after Sunday. Certainly you watched, because you were the holy human volunteer who handed me the chalice, who accepted that meager calling of turning and wiping it after each of us pins our germs to its lip. You saw me, without hesitation, tongue its gilded curvature as if it were, and forgive me for saying this, the smooth give of my beloved's earlobe. And given how long I spent giving a shit about intimacy and its witnesses, I should have space to say, whose tongue has not at least once been where it's not supposed to be, goddammit? Who, because having not admitted this aloud, has not been slicked by shame, stiffened to inaction? O patron saint of digression, hear me out. I did not mean to land here, but if there be in your ranks an unemployed patron saint, let me propose a vocation for them. Patron saint of a love that when this love so moves the lover to a desire verging on cannibalism, cannot help but say, I could just.
Oh, thank you so much. The things that I really, really love about this poem, one is the humor. The Tommy Blount poem, it dismisses the humor pretty quickly, or it moves past it. And here you're just using it in such different ways. It's broader, like the cup reading Dr. S is at your cervix, which is, love it. I want that. I want that mug. I'm not that kind of doctor. My wife. There's, you know, the humor about, you know, not being the best sipper. Sorry also to you, human. Like, there's a kind of strangeness in the language. And so it comes into us different ways, the humor. And it's not, I say this to my students all the time, because I have this bad habit myself of chasing after jokes sometimes when I'm writing. And in this poem, it doesn't feel like you're doing that. It feels like the humor comes from the voice and the situation and sort of the way it's bringing together. Patron saint of digression. That's great. So the questions I wanted to ask you, I'm curious actually just to hear how the poem developed, if you remember, because sometimes I have a hard time remembering, but I'm kind of curious where it started and how it got here, in part because it reminds me in some ways of the Blount poem, like the kinds of intimacy in it, that kind of zooming in.
I actually do remember the kind of genesis of this poem. I was in a workshop with one of my mentors, John Philip Drury, and he gave us an exercise to kind of write an after poem, a poem after. It didn't have to be another poem. It could be anything. And Ross Gay is one of my favorite poets of all time. And this was right around the time the Book of Delights came out, which I loved. And the kind of shortness and concision of the chapters and the essayettes or whatever he calls them, they had a similar voice, kind of bumbling, kind of tell-all, very informal, but also very candid voice. And I remember the cup-licking essay in that book was, I think about him and his mentor having coffee, and there was coffee dripping down the edge of a cup, and the speaker of the essay kind of licks the cup while making eye contact with the person he's sitting down with. And it kind of goes on about that kind of public intimacy and what is appropriate and what is not. And I just ran with that. And of course, you know, I'm always thinking about Catholicism because I was entrenched growing up. So I was like, you know, that I never, as many times as I went to mass as a kid, I never drank the wine because I was just worried about something happening. Like I would spill it, or I would just like kind of make a fool of myself. So as thoughts come to you as a poet, it's like you don't really know where they're from, but there needs to be a place where the thought comes from, even if it's spontaneous. And I think all of that was where the poem came from. And I just, it came out almost exactly like it is in the book, which is a gift, you know, a little like cadence stuff. I might have added the thing about the mug after I thought about it weeks after. But yeah, the voice, the kind of cadence, the ending, especially the patron saint stuff, that's the story. That's as much as I can remember about it.
I love it when I'm jealous, of course, but I love it when the lightning strikes. It's not frequent enough.
Yeah.
But that's great. The other thing I just wanted to mention is it feels like in this poem and others that the humor and the sonic richness often go together.
Mm-hmm.
Like the sound is sometimes generating humor, which I really, sorry also to you, human, whose name I do not know. And did I remember this? Licking is not acceptable. It's just like there's a humor built into the sound. And I just wanted to note how much I like that. So we've got a little bit of a long ad. I feel like I should apologize for this one first, but I'm not going to. This week's episode is brought to you by cattle. Yes, our four-legged friends with their four-chambered stomachs. Recently, there was an intrepid farmer. He was reading old Far Side cartoons, and so he decided to invent his own cow translator. It turned out to be surprisingly effective, and it turns out cows have been able to understand us for years. And as a result, they have created their own cultural touchstones that parallel our own, music, movies, and books, and they're finally being made public to us. In music, you'll love their album Dark Side of the Moo, the songs Shake, Cattle and Roll, and Steers of a Clown, and I Heard It Through the Grapevine. They're, of course, huge fans of Mootown. You're sure to love the Striking Films' Bull Metal Jacket and Livestock and Two Smoking Barrels, but where they really excel is with the novel and other long-form prose. They have all day to think, after all. Cattle are huge fans of Thomas Hardy. You can check out Farm from the Madding Crowd, The Mooer of Casterbridge, and Cud the Obscure. I love their ode to novelist Malcolm Lowry, Utter the Volcano, and I'm working my way through Remembrance of Things Pasteurized. This is really dumb. I love it. I love that I've somehow found a way to make this part of what I do, not that I make money from this. There are other cow novels you're sure to enjoy. Ernest Hemingway's To Cav and Cav Not. Terry McMillan's Cow Stella Got Her Moo Back. Thomas Pynchon's Bovine Land. Virginia Woolf's A Ruminant of One's Own. John Steinbeck's The Grays of Wrath. Zora Neale Hurston's Their Mouths Were Chewing Cud. James Joyce's Moolysses, and of course, Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five. That's cattle. Watch out. They're catching up to us. Okay.
I like the Zora Neale Hurston one. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a lot of fun with Their Mouths Were Chewing. So on to the game. So we're recording in August, and a lot of poets are doing the Seeley Challenge, which, in case listeners don't know, Nicole Seeley, several years ago, decided to read a book of poems every day for a month. And so people are doing that this August. Are you taking part, Nick? Are you trying the Seeley Challenge?
You know, I have done it in the past. I am not doing it this year, though I might, you know, it's never too late. I might try to finish up the rest of the month.
Well, it's the 22nd. You have to catch up by reading enough poems for every day. I can't do it. I get distracted too easily. And yes. I'm a slow reader of poems too. And I feel that when I feel the pressure to read a poem, a book of poems quickly, I just start to get resistant, which is more about me than anything else. But now you get to take part in a game that I'm springing the Seeley Challenge on you, but it's not a poetry quiz.
Right.
I am going to ask you 5 trivia questions about mattresses.
Okay.
It's a Seeley Challenge, Serta. Simple game. Nicholas Mulbear, are you ready to play? I'm springing the Seeley Challenge on you.
I'm ready.
All right. Question number 1. According to a commonly shared idea, after 10 years of use, the weight of a mattress is what? Is it the same weight as when it was purchased, 50% heavier than when it was purchased, 2 times as heavy as when it was purchased, or 3 times as heavy as when it was purchased?
I think I'm going to say 50% heavier.
According to what people say online, it's twice as heavy.
Oh my goodness.
But here's the thing. Very recently, a group of scientists at Ohio State challenged that claim and said it sounded ridiculous. An entomologist said, you know, even though dust mites can produce many times their own weight, even doing that, it's still not enough to make a mattress weigh twice as much. But they do gain weight from dead skin, oil and moisture, and dust mites. Do you want to know how many dust mites a mattress can gather over 10 years?
I feel like I have to know now.
Oh, cool. It can, over 10 years, a mattress contains between 100,000 and 10 million dust mites.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I'm sleeping on the floor tonight. All right. Question number 2. When was the first waterbed invented? Was it A, around 3000 BC, B, around 500 AD, C, in the 1500s, or D, in 1833?
Let's say C, 1500.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's kind of a trick question because I would have accepted 2 different answers.
Oh,
the answers
it D?
Are 3000 BC and 1833. So the first waterbeds were created in ancient Persia, as it turns out. They would fill a goat skin with water, and pretty much only royalty had them. But then in 1833 was the invention of the modern waterbed by a Scottish physician named Neil Arnott. He invented it for invalids with bed sores, which is kind of a surprising fact to me. And just quick note, waterbed sales peaked in 1987, took up about 22% of the market.
I was waiting for like a 1970s-ish answer. I was going to guess that one, but I was like, certainly that's a future question.
It feels like it hung on that way. The guy who basically is responsible for helping market them, you know, said, oh, they're of course for comfort and relaxation, but then would acknowledge, well, yes, people are buying them for sensual reasons. All right. Question three. Modern mattresses are designed to withstand fire, mainly because of the frequency of cigarette burns and people knocking over candles that are next to the bed. In the United States, how long are mattresses legally required to withstand fire? Is it A, 15 seconds, B, 30 seconds, C, 45 seconds, D, 1 minute, E, 2 minutes?
I feel like it has to be longer than 30 seconds or so. I would say 1 minute.
It would be great, but it's only 30 seconds.
Are people waking up that fast if they're...
I know. I was surprised by that because I feel it's like you need a little more time to realize what's going on.
Right.
But, you know, I just like to imagine that they had all these different people from OSHA like testing out how long it took to put out a cigarette burn. That's how they came up with 30 seconds. Okay, question four. This one is only non-multiple choice. This is a pure guess. What is the world record for human mattress dominoes? Meaning each domino is a person and a mattress standing up together, and then each is subsequently knocked over by dominoes. So what's the record? If you guess within 500 of the answer, you get a point. If you guess within 100, you get 5 points. And if you get it exactly, I will make a joyful noise. So
let's see.
So how, what do you think is the world record, which was set in 2023?
Oh, wow. Last year. I will say it's got to be more than 1,000, I would think. No, maybe not. I'll say 700. 713.
I'm very sad to tell you that's not even close. So,
I couldn't ruin it by getting one right at this point. I need all of them wrong.
There is no way anyone would have any of this knowledge unless they sold mattress. This is the result of a lot of Googling. So in 2019 in Brazil, the record was set as 2019. And then in 2023, they set the record in the Philippines by the country Multiflex RNC Philippines Eurotex to promote their Eurotex mattresses, 2,355.
I was gonna say 1,700, you know?
Oh.
I would have been close-ish. Yeah.
Yeah. I have to tell you, the video of it, very disappointing. Not nearly as entertaining as I thought. It's very, very boring to watch.
Fun
it's
fact,
all very slow.
I interviewed before I knew I was moving to Los Angeles. I interviewed for a copywriting position at Purple, mattress company. Yeah. So maybe if I would have gotten that job, who knows if I would have been
you
on this
known
podcast,
the answer,
but I would have gotten the questions right.
All right. There are way too many mattress companies now where they deliver it and you open the box and it just is supposed to expand. That's just, that feels unnatural to me for no good reason at all. Question five, last question. The word mattress comes from what etymological root? A, is it from the Proto-Indo-European root for mother? Is it B, from the Arabic root for to throw? C, is it from the Greek root for meter, meaning measure, or D, is it from the Latin root for dormitory and for sleep in French and other romance languages, which is some variation of dormir. So mother, to throw, meter, or dormir.
You know, I want to say the last one, but it might be too obvious. I'm going to say meter.
Meter would be great. I would love if it were meter. It is unfortunately not. It's from the Arabic, an Arabic word meaning to throw.
Interesting.
And so the Arabic root is taraha, which meant just to throw. And then it led to, I think it's mataraha, which is meaning thing thrown down. So I love the idea of mattress just being a thing thrown down. Not horribly on the quiz, but these are impossible to answer questions. It's the sort of thing where as I was compiling it, I'm like, I'm painting him into a corner. It's not fair.
I was like, I got to get one right. I don't know. You know, not in the cards today.
Well, you know, you're having much more important success. Thank you so much for being here, Nick. Do you want to briefly plug your book or mention anything else before we go?
Yeah. Like you said, my book's coming out or will be out, Altars of Spine Infraction, in September from Northwestern University Press. You can get in touch with me through my website, nicholasmulbear.com, or through Instagram for signed copies of the book in general, that kind of thing. And yeah, if you are listening to this and would like to connect, it would be a joy.
Yeah, thank you so much. Links will be in the show notes to both purchase, or if it's slightly before, then pre-order. And I think the book's really fantastic. I think it's fantastic. So thanks everybody for listening. As always, go read some poems, pet some dogs, and support striking workers wherever you find them. Bye.